Just one. Yeah, okay.
Okay. So, welcome then to the grand finale, the 15th one in this long, long series, five before Christmas and 10 afterwards. And really, we're just sort of summing up a little bit tonight, but maybe dipping into one or two new areas as well, without doing a lot of formal stuff. But the main points that I've been trying to get across every time, I've been summing up as read, understand, and believe, which is a nice little acronym for RUB. So hopefully I haven't been rubbing you up the wrong way. I've been rubbing you up the right way. But anyway, read, understand, believe. How to read the Bible better than we used to do. How to understand it properly in places where sometimes we didn't quite grasp it. And then most important of all, believing things better, believing things more than we used to do, or at least knowing what to believe, the right things to believe, and then being able to obviously put them into practice as well. So with that in mind, I'm obviously going to ask you now to say hopefully nice things about what you've got out of it in these past few weeks. Even if it's only just whatever it is you remember, I might run through a list of things that we have covered, but has it helped you read the Bible better or differently? Has it helped you to understand certain things better? And has it affected how and what you believe, and therefore led to differences that way? So if you want to join in now and respond to that one at a time, I don't know who wants to start.
I'll say
Oh,
first.
yes, Valerie. Okay, Val.
I don't think it's made me believe anymore. It's altered my thought process, and it's caused me to challenge my theology, to use the word. We had a long session on theology on massive issues like the rapture and also salvation. There've been various things. My husband and I now read the Bible out aloud in the mornings, which was one of your recommendations. Also with that chapter and verse, which is brilliant. And there've been various things that I've never understood or even queried before, like the angel in Revelation. The angel at the beginning of the seven churches is actually to one of the officials in the synagogue, which just puts a whole different light on it completely. And it's illuminated all sorts of things. It has completely altered my way of thinking, reading, and understanding. And for that, I do say thank you.
Okay, great. Did you get a new version of the Bible to read, one without chapters and verses? Did you?
Yeah, I bought one from you at the last conference,
Oh, yes.
and the New Testament, or most of the New Testament, and I bought one off the internet for the old.
Okay, which particular one was that? Do you?
I'm away at the moment, and I haven't
Oh,
got
okay.
any, but if you mention a few, it might bring it to mind.
Well, I mentioned one difficult to get called the Immerse one. There was the Reader's Bible. There's the ESV version of it. There was also, just the Books of the Bible, which was the NIV
I
version.
think it was the books of the Bible, that one.
Yeah, which is the main one that I would recommend it
Oh, good.
for that. So
Yeah,
good.
it
And
wasn't.
reading the
It
Bible
wasn't.
out loud was one of the ways of getting
Yeah.
into it in a new way.
Yeah.
Particularly reading it to someone else slows you
Yeah.
down. It enables you to focus in more on what's there. I'm going to pick that up actually a little later this evening. And you mentioned the theology bit. And I know you said to me afterwards, did I get through it all? Was I a bit rushed at the end? We could do a bit of a recap on one or two of those things if people feel that was a good topic to explore. The three things that I'm trying to dig out of the well, the mud, the dirt that gets in the way, is the way the Bible has been translated, often in a way that isn't helpful. Big topic that I've only really briefly touched on that. The other way was to look at how tradition has affected the way we read the Bible. And there's a lot been going on in 2,000 years, which has changed everything. And also how theology has affected the way our Bibles have been talked about taught from, and so on. And often theology gets in the way. I would sum it up as saying, if nothing else, I hope you're understanding there's a difference between church-based Christianity and Bible-based Christianity.
Yeah.
They're often not the same. In fact, often there's a big disconnect between them, and therefore the two sides of it don't function properly. But if you can bring the Bible back, fully opened, as like the ancient Wells, into a proper functioning ecclesia, then you've got the best of everything, and we might eventually end up back with a Christ-based Christianity, which is what it's been all about. So thank you for that. Anyone else want to add along those lines?
Can you hear, Paul?
Yes, I can hear you, Judy.
Yeah, just a question for you. Do you think that because we've moved on 2,000 years, that people's understanding of the Bible is being distorted by modern day? We often refer to say, well, it's applicable today as it was yesterday or 2,000 years ago. But do you think we're trying to twist some things to fit modern society? Mm.
Oh, yes, definitely I would. Somebody could argue that, well, you know, after 2,000 years, you've got to find new ways of applying things. And in fact, just as in Jesus' day, they were having to work out how to use their, what we call the Old Testament, because it was already an ancient document for them. How did the law of Moses actually apply in Jesus' time? So you've always got to think, if time has moved on, sometimes you've got to move on a bit as well. But there's no doubt that when it comes to the truth of the Bible, and that it's been affected all the way through 2,000 years of history by whatever the dominant ideologies and philosophies of the time and place have been. So today's spirit of the age, whatever's dominating people's thinking today, is absolutely affecting what people get out of the Bible or don't get out of the Bible or the way it's proclaimed or whatever. And it's a big, big thing, because since the Enlightenment and since other major events like that, the way men have been thinking has changed completely, and therefore the way the Bible has been subject to what eventually became known as higher criticism, or basically liberal theology and all the rest of it, it's completely changed the nature of the way we feel we can handle the Word of God. So... yes, is the short answer to that. So, do other people feel the same sort of thing?
I was going to say, Paul, that it's made me question a lot more, rather than, you know, you say, to read, believe, and understand, or read, understand, and believe. It's made me question a lot of things that I had maybe assumed previously. So that's one of the things it's done. And like Valerie, I bought one of the Bible Without Verses when I was with it, Foundations 10, I think, with you guys. But I've managed to get my hands on the whole Bible. It's this NIV one. It's just the books of the Bible.
Yeah.
And I was reading that as well, which is helpful. But I think these sort of meetings are very beneficial. I really enjoy them.
Yeah.
It challenges and makes you... It challenges me to think about some of the things that I've maybe assumed previously or things that I've been wrong about even.
We have assumed a lot. We've either assumed it from our own reading or that you hear it proclaimed repeatedly as though it must be true. And I think there are certain things that need questioning. It puts a great, if I say this sort of personally, it puts a great strain on me to think that I'm actually helping people to do that. Because one is, I want you to be asking the right questions and get good answers and not being a bit of a maverick. But also, it means that I'm questioning things that even I thought I'd got sorted out. And sometimes things that I feel I don't want to give up and change. But at the same time, and I think I shared this as a sort of testimony, that when I was converted in my early teens, the early part of my Christian experience, as well as going to a good evangelical Baptist church, was that I simply read the Bible. So I got to know the Bible from the Bible rather than from other people. And I'm immensely grateful to God that I did it that way round. And then only in later life came across all the things that people had said and all the other books and so on. And if there's one thing to encourage you to do, it's not just, it is mainly just to keep reading and reading and reading, because God will tell you what he wants you to know there, but also to ask him to develop a sense of discernment. And by that I mean a sort of mature discernment, not a sort of easy spiritual gift discernment, which can be useful, but one which she comes out of knowing the truth, so you know even more of the truth. You know what I mean? So ask God to discern, help me give you discernment, so that when you hear something or read something, you know whether it chimes in with the truth of Scripture or whether it's going in a different direction.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to join in at this stage on anything? We will have more of these eventually. It's just that, one, I need a break, and with other things coming up. And although I've done most of what I wanted to do on this, I want time to reassess it again a little bit. I do intend at some point to put some of these studies down in a form that can be looked at again, whether it's written or a different way of talking about it or so on. So it's not the end by any means, from my point of view.
Paul, I think in terms of feedback, I think it'd be worth giving people another opportunity to answer that question about have they found it helpful, because at the moment only Valerie's answered that question, and I think everybody here would, or certainly more than just one person, would have something to say about how valuable they found.
Okay, yeah, we've heard from two or three, but I'm happy to keep this running if possible, but I don't want to force people to say anything. But please, yes, anything that you want to say, even if it was only on that particular occasion you showed me how to read or understand this, that is enough, just one thing.
Well, I found it very helpful when you tackled the Returning King, which I previously would have entitled Looking at Revelation.
Okay.
I just found it a really helpful approach to take one New Testament character and approach it as if from his eyes.
Yes.
So you were suggesting, I believe, was it Luke or John?
Well, it was John, because John ended up in Patmos and he got the final revelation. My approach, if I'm spending, as I have done the past 2 or 3 years, teaching the whole stuff, start with John as a disciple of Jesus, figure what Jesus said, then dig into John's knowledge from the Old Testament, and then work forward towards the book of Revelation, rather than leap straight into the book of Revelation and hope you'll understand it all first time.
And actually, I've found that thinking about other issues biblically, that's not a bad approach.
Yeah.
Thinking about, other subjects like, my mind's gone blank, but I just like that approach when starting to think about other things.
And by that approach, do you mean put yourself in the position, say, of one of Jesus's disciples?
Yes.
And start with Jesus.
And start with Jesus and then go into the Hebrew scriptures.
Yeah.
Without understanding that that the Hebrew scriptures were the foundation not only for Jewish believers, but for Jesus himself and for almost all of the writers of the New Testament. So really, without understanding them, we're going to miss more than half, probably more than three quarters of what they were on about.
Indeed. And
May I just quickly say something?
Yes, indeed.
Within the Jewish world, when the Bible was originally translated out of Hebrew into Latin, within the Jewish world, there's recorded a great deal of mourning, a great deal of sadness, because they felt that at least 75% of the understanding and revelation within the Hebrew would be lost as soon as you took it out of its original language. Which is so true. And it also, the way that it's interpreted and the way that we understand it is essentially Hebraic, because that's why that was God's choice of language to record his character and his purposes within. So there's so much depth in it that is just missed.
Yeah.
interesting, is it's so interestingly, to the nations, it was a time of great celebration that the scriptures were being translated into other languages, but to the Jewish world, it was a time of great mourning.
Yeah. So what, on that basis, would you say the same about the Septuagint then being a Greek version of it? Because so much of the quotations into the New Testament from the Old were often based upon the Septuagint. So obviously they got used to it in that sense and were happy to use it. But again, it's not always as good as going back to the Hebrew, I suppose.
No, and I've even heard Orthodox rabbis who aren't Messianic, they still study the New Testament sometimes in the Greek, and they often believe that it was originally a Hebrew book because they say there are Hebrewisms within it.
Yeah.
Don't make sense in the Greek. Now, I'm not a Greek scholar, so I wouldn't be able to attest to that, but I find it fascinating that they'll study it as a historical book and say, this sounds like it should really be in the another language.
Indeed, and I do a whole course on Hebrew idioms and insights, looking at things that, when you read them in English, they don't make a lot of sense. You realise that it's a translation of a translation almost, but if you take it back to what had originally been said and how it was understood, it makes a huge difference. So I quite agree. A lot of it is, particularly in the Gospels, there's very much a Hebraic background to that, which as soon as you start explaining it, people go, oh, yes, of course, so that's what it meant. That's what it meant. I'll try to think of a quick one off the top of my head, but people, it's quite common, the one where Jesus says the Son of Man, or I think he refers to himself as the Son of Man in this case, has nowhere to lay his head. And people tend to think that means that Jesus didn't have a bed for the night, or that he had to sleep off, and it was really tough following him, when in fact that expression is nothing to do with going to sleep, it's to do with teaching. To lay your head upon someone means to pass on what you know, to give information, to teach them in a certain way. And what Jesus is actually saying at that point, where he says the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head, means I don't have a Bible school, I don't have a regular place where you come and learn from me. If you're going to be my disciple, you're going to have to take it from me as and when it occurs. So keep walking with me, stay next to me, because I might suddenly start teaching you. I don't just do Zoom meetings at 7 o'clock on a Thursday evening. Probably end up with that, but you get the idea how we miss that. Everybody seems to think, oh, poor Jesus, he's saying he's got nowhere to sleep, and if you're going to follow him, it's going to be tough. You're going to be kipping down in the hedges and the ditches overnight. He's actually saying something totally different because he's speaking in a Hebrew way.
And where do you,
doesn't learn.
Where did you learn things like that, about that particular one?
Want me to reveal my sources?
I definitely do.
Well, over the years, I have read many books. I have listened to things. People have told me these things. There is a lot out there. I just advise you to, unless I start to do more of this on another occasion, where I've probably got more sort of notes in front of me to say where I've got things from, because they actually can come from lots of different places now. In a few years ago, it was quite new, but now there's a lot of books about the Jewishness of Jesus and the great nature of the Gospels.
It's a slightly tongue-in-cheek comment, but actually it is a serious comment, because if we are going to pass on some of these things that you say on the basis of, well, someone told me and I trust them, that's not really a strong enough basis for saying, I would like you to re-examine the way you've interpreted that scripture.
Yes, well, there's two things to that. One is, if you hear it in more than one source, that's useful. Although sometimes actually one person is just repeating someone else anyway, so you just be careful. But you put it back, put it back within the context of who Jesus was talking to and the nature of what he said, because actually he followed it up by talking about birds and nests and foxes and holes. So you have to understand that within the context of his comparison and ask yourself, why do birds build nests? And why do foxes build holes? What do they do in nests and holes?
they go to bed at night, don't they?
No, they don't. Birds don't go to sleep in nests. Nests in order to lay eggs to bring up their young.
Ah, thank you.
Which is discipleship.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. The essence of discipleship is a father-son relationship. You're training someone up. So birds build nests in order to have a place where they can bring up their young. And foxes have holes in order to have their babies, basically. And then if you look at the bigger context of that tiny little parable within the context of the three different people that Jesus is talking to, it is the cost of following him. But the cost isn't necessarily a physical one of knowing where you're going to sleep at night. And the other thing, Nigel, on this is that you think about Middle Eastern hospitality with Jesus, who was popular. You don't let someone like that kip out in the fields at night. You give him a bed. You put a roof over his head.
Yeah, I'm not challenging that particular one.
No, I know you're not.
I'm just wanting to. I'm wanting to be able to quote sources.
Exactly. But what I'm saying is that when I heard that from someone else, I thought, okay, let me think how realistic this is. Go back to the text, put it in the bigger context, think about the wider thing of Middle Eastern hospitality and so on, and the fact that there's no reason to actually believe that Jesus had to live a rough and ready sort of life.
No, I agree.
He wandered around a lot, and maybe sometimes he didn't always have a big meal to eat at the end of the day, but I'm sure he was looked after. We've got a very strange view of Jesus sometimes, based upon misunderstandings like that. We almost try and, shall we say, do Jesus down a little bit or make things out to be more difficult for him than it necessarily was. Anyway, unless someone else wants to come in with, you know, how wonderful it's all been for the past few weeks and how it's changed your whole life, I could come back to the thing I ended up with last time, and I left you to think about it, and I think it's only fair that I give us a chance to think about it. And you remember I gave an example of Remez from Matthew 21?
Yes.
Matthew 21 verse 13. Matthew 21 verse 13. There are parallels in other Gospels, but this will do. And this is another very good case of exactly what we've been talking about with the Hebrew nature of the Gospels and the things that Jesus said. And in Matthew 21:13, it's well known that Jesus, having overturned the tables in the temple, he says, "It's written, 'My house will be called a house of prayer, but you are making it a den of thieves.'" And my point in that is that Jesus there was actually quoting briefly two passages from the Old Testament, and you've probably got a Bible that helps you find them, because there's footnotes to point you to Isaiah 56 and Jeremiah 7. And the first point was that Jesus expected that they would have known the scriptures well enough to pick up from a tiny hint, three or four words, a whole passage, a whole chapter even, and all the meaning from Isaiah 56 and from Jeremiah 7 will immediately come to mind. And in this case, because he's cleverly combined two of them, their minds will be going from one to the other and building up an even bigger picture of what he was saying. So this was a typical rabbinic way of teaching. And the word remez, R-E-M-E-Z, which means clue or hint or allusion, is that by just dropping a little hint or allusion to another passage, it gets the whole message across without having to spend 20 minutes giving a sermon on it, if you like. So with that in mind, I said, well, we probably don't know Isaiah 56 perfectly or Jeremiah 7 perfectly. We'd have to go back and read it all again to try and get the message from these two passages. And then, of course, if you want to spend ages studying it, then you can build it up even more. But the point in Isaiah 56, particularly being late Isaiah, is, as the heading seems to suggest, salvation for others. This is about the Gentiles eventually coming into God's plan. And so from verse 7, which is where the little quote comes from, this is foreigners who bind themselves to the Lord, to serve him, to love the name of the Lord, keep the Sabbath, and so on. These will I bring to my holy mountain and give them joy in my house of prayer. And then later, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations. Now, Jesus didn't even say a house of prayer for all nations. He leaves that hanging. He expects them to know that, because it's not just a house of prayer for them. It's meant to be a house of prayer for everyone. And Jesus is bothered here with their money changing and all the rest of it, that it would be putting, it'd be giving God's name a bad name, if you like, giving the house, his temple, a bad reputation amongst the other nations, who would be thinking, well, this is not for me then, is it? This is going to keep me out. And the other hint or reference is in Jeremiah 7, which is a little more developed and therefore a little more involved for us to get into. But just a brief glance through Jeremiah 7 should tell you that the prophet here is going on about false religion and how worthless it is. And although the actual quote or the hint is from verse 11, has this house which bears my name become a den of thieves to you? For I've been watching. I mean, this is a very tough passage. And just by using the phrase den of thieves, they are going to get a really big message based upon Jeremiah 7. Because what Jeremiah had to proclaim to the people here is, okay, you go to the temple, you spend a lot of time in the temple, do all the things there, but the rest of your life is way out from what I want. So this is going back to the beginning of the chapter, when he says, stand at the gates of the Lord's house and proclaim this message, and so on. It goes on, reform your ways and your actions, and I will let you live in this place. Do not trust in deceptive words and say, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. It's as though they had some kind of mantra that they could trot out, basically on the lines of, well, I go to church every Sunday, I'm okay. You know, I'm okay with God because I go to church, I go to church, I go to church. And God is saying, that's not good enough, because you're not living your lives properly. And you can follow that through, and they do all sorts of wicked things. And once we get past, because this little hint in verse 11 is not only working backwards in Jeremiah 7, but forwards as well. So once they've picked up all that Jesus is saying about how badly they're behaving, even though they go to the temple, there's a hint in Jeremiah 7, go to the place in Shiloh where I first made a dwelling for my name. And actually Jeremiah is giving a little hint back to something earlier in the scriptures. He's reminding them of Shiloh. Think what happened there. And I guess for most of us as well, we'd scratch our heads and think, don't remember that very well. Got to go back into my scriptures and work out what happened at Shiloh. Well, briefly, this was the first place where God set up a building with his name on it. It's before they had the temple proper in Jerusalem. What happened there was that it was destroyed. God eventually destroyed his place in Shiloh through their idolatry and so on. So Jeremiah is already reminding the Israelites that God did something in the past in Shiloh, and Jesus is referring back to Jeremiah and referring back to Shiloh. And at the end of all this, you get the idea that God isn't very pleased with the way they're living. Unless they put it right, they are going to lose the temple in exactly the same way as in the past the Israelites lost the temple. And of course that came true eventually. So if nothing else, there's a huge amount packed into one small statement by Jesus, if, as they did, you actually know where he's quoting from.
Do you think he's also talking about himself?
In what way?
Well, in the way that we know that he later refers to himself. He is basically the human embodiment of the eternal temple. in so many ways. That's really clear. And so maybe he's saying to Jewish people, you, in Isaiah 56, in the context, it's something like you're calling on my name, you're going to the place where my name is, but you're also then also behaving contrary to the character and purpose of my name. And so is he perhaps giving two layers in what he's teaching in the Newer Testament, saying you're going to lose me for a bit because he's going to extract himself out of being available to be seen as the Messiah from his own people for a bit.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting because this means we're digging into it a bit more now and thinking it through. You may be right. I hadn't actually seen it that much myself. Later on, he certainly compares himself to the temple and it's going to be gone for 3 days and come back again. I think what I would get out of that from this extra layer, if you like, is that he's saying, in the end, what you need as your temple is me, or you need a temple that isn't just a building, and I am going to provide you with that temple. I don't know whether he's giving them a warning at this point that they're going to lose him as their temple, because I'm not sure they're thinking in those terms yet at this point. But it's an idea, and it might be. But there could be all sorts of extra links. This is the wonder of studying Hebraically, is that you're allowed to go off into any sort of related, not quite a tangent, any related sort of area, particularly with similar words, and do what we call midrash on it, and think whether or not there's extra layers of meaning that maybe if they weren't immediately apparent to those Jesus talked to, maybe they become more apparent later on to people in Bible times, or indeed us. So, yeah, good idea, good thinking. Now, there is a whole load of similar examples of where Jesus does something like this. Okay, we could have an evening on this at some point, just purely on Remez. Yeah?
Yes, please.
Okay, and just to tempt you and tease you then, I mean, we could do some more tonight, but I thought I would do, you know, a bit of variety, see if I want to do something else in a minute. But what do you think Jesus meant? Of course, it's easy if your Gospels give you footnote references. If you don't pick them up. You're really struggling. But what do you think Jesus meant when it says, I'll get there eventually. So if men do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry? Now, the chances are, I'll say it again, if men do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry? The first thing you've got to think of, did Jesus have to say that? Or is that something that Jesus said? Yes, he did.
Oh, what's your reference? Who are you?
Ah, well, I'm not telling you yet. I'm being deliberate on this. Okay. I'm just saying. I quite understand, because the reference will help, but and I will tell you in a minute. But just I want you to get the flavour, first of all, that you've just heard Jesus say that. For if men do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry? Does it resonate with anything you've read in the Old Testament at all?
Yes, it's in Jeremiah, I think.
What do you think it's about then?
I'm rusty on it. I have looked at it.
Okay. Well, nice try. It isn't quite Jeremiah. It's another one like that. And it's not Isaiah either. And now I'll tell you the context. He's actually saying this while he's carrying his cross.
Yes, I know it's on the Via Dolorosa.
He's on his way to Calvary, which means that, one, physically he's in quite a state. Two, he hasn't got a lot of time. In fact, he cannot stop and deliver a sermon. But by using this technique and by using this particular phrase, it will resonate with anybody listening to it that knows that they can find it in Ezekiel chapters 20 and 21. By the way, it's in Luke's Gospel. It's in Luke chapter 23 and verse 31. So that was Luke 23:31.
Oh, I've got the answers, of course, now.
Oh, yeah.
A green tree and a dry tree are used to symbolise the righteous and the wicked.
Yes, good. And the context in Ezekiel, you need to look somewhere in the end of Ezekiel 20 and the beginning of Ezekiel 21. And by the way, has anybody got a footnote reference in Luke to the passage in Ezekiel at all? I think it's highly unlikely.
I have it because I've written it in.
Yeah, well, I've done it as well. And I know why you've written it in, Harriet, because I'm not saying you did get it from me, but you were probably at the...
No, I had it first a long time
ago. Oh, well done, okay.
But it says again, call to mind the entire context of the passage. And Jesus was speaking to daughters of Jerusalem and saying, don't you weep for me. You've got to be weeping for yourselves and your children, because days are coming when you will rue the day you were ever born.
Yeah.
A time of retribution and shame is coming.
Yeah. So to translate that particular phrase he's using, he's saying, if men are doing these things to me and I'm the righteous one, what are they going to do to you who are not righteous when your time comes? Now, there's even more to it than that, because the context in Ezekiel 20 and 21 is one of judgment, and it's based upon fire and indeed the sword. But basically, if a fire is strong enough to burn up a tree that is green, i.e. it's got its sap in it, is live, then how easily will it burn up those that are dead, dry? So don't weep for me. Think about what's going to happen to you, because if I've ended up like this, basically if the Romans are doing this to me, I suppose, but if this has happened to me, what do you think could happen to you? Anyway, I can leave you to dig further into Ezekiel and see if you can understand what Jesus was saying even more because of that. So, that might be an interesting future study on the Hebraic nature of Jesus' teaching and the use of the Old Testament. Jolly good. Any more questions? Otherwise, I shall move on to another slightly different topic, which I would like, again, just to introduce you to an idea to pursue. But I'll give you a couple of minutes to respond. Has anyone got anything to say?
Remez.
Yeah, someone's saying something.
Yeah, me.
Well, say it again, sorry.
I agree with Nigel that we should have more tea. We should have a whole session on Remez.
It's a very good evening, because yes. I can take you through 10, 12 of these. I mean, I've done sort of a couple now. Yes. But we'll put the text up on the screen. We'll put the extra things. There's even more than I've... I haven't got my notes in front of me on this, but there's a lot more. And Jesus does it all the time. You know, often because it's a quick and easy way of saying a lot. But we need to get more into our Hebrew scriptures in order to understand better
what
we're saying. And they're not always clear. So, good. Yeah, I can certainly put this on a future list.
Yeah, I definitely would like that.
Okay. Well, it will happen then at some point. So here's something that I was sort of wanting to do. Wasn't sure how well it would work, but it's sort of end of term time, so I can get away with it if it doesn't. You don't have to come back next week. I talked about, and you picked up the idea of reading slowly and carefully and reading out loud, slowing yourself down, all the rest of it. And I also mentioned about using your imagination when you're reading certain passages, painting pictures, if you like, because a lot of the Bible is written in order to paint a picture in your mind. And our way of reading often is just eye skimming over words. And brain half picking it up, half falling asleep, half forgetting it sort of 30 seconds later. So it's the idea of actually making a film of what you're reading. Now, for some people, this might be, oh, that's interesting. And others might think, oh, golly, I can't cope with that. So just bear with me and see what you think. I'm going to take you through a very well-known passage and just outline the ideas. So we're going to look in Genesis 22. Genesis 22. It's the first 19 verses. Genesis 22, the first 19 verses. And the idea is to put yourself in the position of someone who has been asked to make a film of this passage, or some kind of drama, or present it in some visual way. Doesn't matter how you really think about it. Now, if you found it, you'll recognize straight away this is called Abraham Tested. It's Abraham, Isaac, and the testing of Abraham. And the whole point about approaching it this way is to make you think about the characters involved. Who's the main characters? Who are the incidental characters? What role do they have? In other words, if you are casting people into this, how many people do you need? Because sometimes we read something and we miss someone. We do miss someone that's in the picture. And it'd be very interesting, coming back to what Nigel was saying about the man in Mark who fled when his garment was ripped from him. If you were filming that passage, how would you cope with that? You'd have to make a decision as to who you think he is there. So it's about looking at the characters. It's looking at the dialogue that goes on. How much is dialogue? How much is action? How much, when you are filming it, do you find the plot, if you like, the rising action, the tension, the falling action, the resolution? How does the story work as a story? And if you're doing it as a film, you then, as a director, have to make decisions of spatial and temporal importance. In other words, long shots or close-ups. At what point do you want to focus in on someone's face, or how much of it is a long shot? And the temporal side of it is, what's the speed of the action at this point? Are we slowing it down? Are we rushing it on? And so on. So how do you build up the story through, you know, spatial elements, temporal elements? And if you really wanted to do this in great detail, and because it's your thing, then you set up some kind of grid or some kind of table, and you'd storyboard the whole thing, and you'd put things like S1, meaning spatially close up, to S10, long distance, and so on. I'm not suggesting you necessarily have to do all that, but the idea is to get into the story differently. So we're going to have a bit of a go. I hope this works in this format, because it's a very familiar story, but let's see if we can get at the essence of it as we go through it. Now, the first thing you'd have to decide is, what's your title going to be for this passage? Any idea what you think you ought to call it?
Ultimate Test.
Okay. Any other ideas?
Yeah, The Substitution.
Okay, yeah.
Offering of Isaac.
Say it again, I think I heard someone.
The Offering of Isaac.
The Offering of Isaac, yeah. That's an interesting one. Your choice of title, and again, sometimes you don't decide the title till you've got to the end, but your choice of title is actually indicating what it is you're really trying to get across. And when it says in the Bible, as a heading, maybe Abraham tested, that's saying that's the most important thing. Abraham's the most important person. This is what it's all about. You've already switched that, shifted it a bit in a lot of your suggestions, away from Abraham to Isaac. Are you aware of how the Jews regard this story? What their title is for?
They call it Acadia. It means the binding of Isaac.
The binding of Isaac.
But my suggestion, The Substitution, is actually the star of this story is the ram.
Okay, that's an interesting point, because So ultimately, yes, you want to focus in, not on the humans, but on the ram, because you're bringing out the substitutionary nature of this, and therefore the gospel for later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, that's interesting. I was going to call it the ram, the fire, and the knife. Ram, the knife, and the fire.
Okay. Yeah. Good. It's interesting, isn't it? Using imagination, finding a title for it helps you to get into the story. By the way, Jenny, how did you pronounce that? I say Akedah. What do you say?
Acadia.
Acadia.
Okay. It doesn't matter.
Okay. Fine. But
I like yours better.
well, it's the binding of Isaac.
Yeah.
Because Isaac is the hero of this story. I mean, Abraham is pretty important as well, but actually Isaac is the main thing. And if you're casting it, you've got to cast Isaac right, otherwise it isn't going to work. Now, again, most of you know enough about the Bible to know what I'm coming to now, is if you're casting Isaac, how old is he going to be?
In his 30s.
Yeah, exactly. You don't cast a 10-year-old boy. You've got to cast a young man in his prime, probably about 30s. There are various suggestions from places like Josephus and so on as to how old he was, but it's very clear from the narrative itself that we can't have a small boy in this. It has to be a full-grown man. And that changes everything, as I'm sure you probably know, or you'll see soon. But if you're working your way through this story now, and without trying to do it all, let's look at the main issues that you would have to face when trying to put it into a sort of story thing. It does start with Abraham being called and tested. So somehow you have got to get this conversation across as almost... it's only known between God and Abraham. No one else hears this. So your first job as the director would be to find a way of getting Abraham to understand what God wanted him to do. That could be quite a challenge. And in fact, as I say, when you're thinking about dialogue and close-ups, what sort of facial expression might you have on Abraham's face when he hears these words? Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go and sacrifice, and so on. It's poignant. It's got to really come across. The rest of the story will fall flat if you don't get across the essence of what's going on there and what that would mean. I'm told it's the first mention of the word love in the Bible, actually, is that. But your son, your only son. By the way, was he his only son?
No.
Technically not. There's already Ishmael around. But, as we're going to obviously know, Isaac is the only son that really counts when it comes to God's promises. So this is a big, big moment. Do you also pick up, I'm not saying you could use this, but do you pick up a resonance forwards this time to the baptism of Jesus, when God says, "This is my son whom I love," and so on?
Mm.
See, actually, I think that here's a remez. God the Father at the baptism is hinting back to this particular passage.
Yes, definitely.
And similarly at the transfiguration, I think, as well.
Paul? Imagination's running here. So you've just thought of Isaac as being 30-ish. Can you imagine, did or was Isaac so trusting in his father that he would even lay down and allow his older father to tie him onto an altar for sacrifice? Yeah. I mean, surely Isaac must have had some...
Hello,
inspiration or some knowledge from God, a sense of feeling that he would allow it to happen?
It's not in the story, is it?
No, it's not, but you're just asking me to use my imagination.
I know.
30-year-old isn't going to get
using your imagination doesn't mean putting things in that aren't there. but you're absolutely right, because this is the key point. And if someone hasn't spotted this fact about Isaac's age and therefore his strength.
Yeah.
Who was the dominant figure here? Isaac. If Isaac wanted to have done, he could have bumped Abraham, knocked him over, and run off.
Mm.
In the end, he was willing, and jumping ahead, and we can do in the story, at some point it will become obvious to Isaac what is really going to happen,
yes,
or what is meant to really happen. To start with, though, he doesn't. He doesn't have any idea.
Mm.
And part of your job as the storyteller here would be to work out the point at which Isaac, through the questions that he asks, Father, yes, my son,
where's the sacrifice?
Where's the lamb? Mm. And then God gives an answer, and that seems to satisfy him, and on they go, and on they go, and there'll come a point, no more conversation, and it's always interesting that the sort of balance between dialogue and action, at which point, at the moment when Abraham starts to bind his son, something goes on there. You know, something amazing happens there. But we haven't got to that point in the story yet, because if you're telling it, you're still in verse 3, it's early the next morning, Abraham gets up and he saddles his donkey. Now, don't forget the donkey in the story. The donkey is quite important, possibly, anyway. But what is important here, actually, is that Abraham saddles his donkey. He wouldn't normally do that. That's a job for servants. And Abraham has got servants. But for some reason, Abraham does it himself here. Oh, by the way, I could have gone back a bit more into verse 2, this thing that God is saying. When he says, take your son, although it could sound like a very fierce command, it's a gentle expression. It's almost like a request. I mean, it's not, it is a command, but it's not, you shouldn't have God acting fiercely at this point. And when it says, sacrifice him there, offer him there, it's literally lift him up or even exalt him. And lift him up to me, if you like.
Can I just make an observation at this point about?
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody has ever been satisfied with any film rendering of hearing God's voice.
Yeah.
I've never been satisfied, and I've stopped watching films about Bible stories because I find them so unsatisfying. And also very strongly, they take my memory. And so when I read the scripture after watching a film, I think about the film rather than the word. So,
Do you mean that the voice of God is booming and strong? And
exactly. All sorts of different ways they've tried to do it, and none of them seem true to how I hear God's voice.
Okay. I mean, that's a very good point, because it means that right at the beginning of this attempt to tell the story, you've hit a major problem.
Exactly.
how do you depict God in any of these things, particularly when it's obviously an internal experience of some kind? So perhaps you would show Abraham having a dream or something. You might think, oh, at what point are we getting away from the way the scripture depicts it? Are we taking some kind of liberty here? But if you don't want God as a sort of external character booming a voice at him, what do you do instead? Do you give Abraham an experience of God?
We watched Noah on Friday. No, this is Thursday. The other day, anyway. And he basically heard God in his head, so we didn't know what God said to him, and it was a bit stupid, really.
Mm.
But unless you knew the Bible, you didn't know what was going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I just want to say, Nigel, I agree with that point. I was even watching a drama in a church recently where someone was trying to play the role of God's voice, and I really hated it.
Mm.
Even though it still doesn't get it, I guess the ones that I sometimes find the most beautiful or ethereal, they're not even close, but they are the animated ones.
Okay.
I'm thinking of Prince of Egypt. when the burning bush, and there's this, or some of the animations that are really quite beautiful because they can do things that are beyond the natural, and they get sort of that ethereal quality. But even then, the voice is never, it's never enough. It's never the same. It's never got the full spectrum of how God's voice sounds to me in the myriad of circumstances in which he's spoken to me. He couldn't ever come close.
Yeah. This is a very good point, and it might mean that if you are going to choose a passage to do, you don't pick one where God directly speaks or is there. You might have the same problem with Jesus. How do you make him come across realistically? Because many films don't do that. Or maybe you just want to only have human characters in it, just make it easier. Hey, but for tonight, we'll stop with this one, okay? Because it's worth it.
Of course.
Despite the problems. I got to Abraham saddling his donkey, which was quite unusual, but there are two servants there, so you've got to cast them, even though they are silent. I've got a feeling they don't say anything. So you need some spare parts, or whatever they call them, extras or something. And then you've got to have him putting wood on the... cutting the wood... I mean, so quickly, it just says, when you cut enough wood for the burnt offering, you've got to ask the question, okay, how much wood is that? How much do you need for a burnt offering? You've got to go back and think what a whole burnt offering was like. It took a lot of wood. A lot of wood. So it's no good just picking up a couple of sticks and thinking that will do. Otherwise, you're going to have a problem later on. You've got to cut enough wood, and he sets out for the place. And then all of a sudden, verse 4, what's happened? Verse 4, what's happened? Where are we now?
So go
on.
You're about 8 or 10 miles from the place.
Okay.
I mean, I was there in January, so that's why I'm saying it.
All right. Well, I was trying to give you a time perspective, not much a spatial one. On the third day. That's what I'm getting at there. In verse 4, suddenly it's on the third day.
And raised his eyes, which is a Hebraicism with considerable overtones.
Yes, because it's the doubling of the verb, he looked up and saw, which is a very common Hebraic phrase. It doesn't mean that he was looking down at his feet and suddenly he looked up and saw. It's just the phrase that he suddenly saw. But it doubled up for emphasis.
It's always a meaningful seeing.
Yeah, it is. I think it's, I might get this wrong, did Isaac suddenly look up and see Rebecca arriving? So the first moment he saw her, that sort of thing. Anyway, the point of getting it is, if you're going to film this, what are you going to do about those other 2 days? Nice film music in the background, long shots of them travelling on and on and on, and the sun going down and up again and all the rest of it. There's a time period here which we just read straight past. You could actually try and make something of this in the sense that this event is going to happen 3 days afterwards. Is 3 days a common sort of biblical pattern of time being used?
Very much so.
Although, yes, you're right, it is. You could say that in Abraham's mind, Isaac died the moment God spoke to him. And it takes 3 days before he's brought back to life in his mind. So although the sacrifice doesn't happen, it doesn't happen at all, but as long as it doesn't happen for 2 days and so on. And eventually you're building up towards the key moment. Abraham takes the wood, and at this point, he's saying goodbye to the servants and the donkey. You haven't forgotten the donkey, have you? He had an important role to play, even though he was silent as well. Find another passage if you want a talking donkey, but this one's silent. Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy... Now, the word boy there might confuse you. Better translations, anyone, for the word boy? In your translations, what have you got?
Lad.
Lad is better, yes. Youth, maybe. You might think, why is he still called boy or lad and so on, if he really is in his 30s? And that's because he isn't yet married. Okay, so until you were married, you weren't a man. I always cringe at that point, but anyway, there we go. But the boy is a bad translation if it makes you think of, as I say, about a 10-year-old holding hands and trotting along with his father and so on. We will worship, we will come back to you. And then all this wood that had been put on the donkey is now placed upon his son. And it's at this point that you've got to have a young man and so on. And it's interesting, you might try and work out something here. By the way, as far as Isaac's age has got, my notes, the estimates vary between 23 and 37. It's a pretty wide estimate, but there are no actual time periods specifically to date him. It always says, if you go back to the beginning of chapter 22, sometime later. And then in verse 20, after this story is over, sometime later. And then later on in verse 23, you've got Sarah's age. So you get some time points, but not very clear fixed ones. But in your story now, you've reached this crucial moment. The wood is being taken off the donkey and placed on his son, and Abraham carries the fire and the knife. That'd be quite a scene. You'd have to think, close up, what are you going to try and put across? How much time spent on that? And if you don't like the idea of making a film of it, it's still imagining it in your head as you work through this, instead of just reading a series of words with verse numbers next to them. So the scene has changed between the two of them. And now just the two of them go on together. And then, as we said, Isaac now speaks. And he asks a very fair question. He had been used to seeing lambs sacrificed. He knew what was going on, except there is no lamb. And then they reach the place, and Abraham builds the altar. And again, we read that so quickly, it probably took him a long time to build this altar. Each moment would be agony for him, building it bit by bit, putting the wood on it, and then approaching his son and asking him to put out his hands so that he could bind him. And as I said before, this is the moment, if Isaac wanted to, he could have pushed his father over, because Abraham was at what, about 100 by now, is he? No, he's 100 when Isaac was born. Sorry, he's 100 when Isaac was born. So, you know, even by those standards, that he wasn't perhaps in his prime, unlike his son. And you get to the great drama of him taking the knife and then the angel of the Lord calling out from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. This is one of the great double calls of Scripture. I don't know if you know these, the times when God speaks someone's name twice. Abraham, Abraham. Can you think of any more? Top of your head?
Saul? No, who was it? The young lad.
Moses?
Oh, Samuel.
Yeah, unfair question to drop it on you like that, particularly.
What verse are you in?
Sorry, say again.
What verse are you in? Sorry,
I'm looking at verse 11, where the angel of the Lord calls out Abraham, Abraham, and off the top of my head, I said there are many occasions when God speaks someone's name twice, and I fairly asked you to think of some without me fully knowing myself. I think Samuel might have been one.
Can I put in Jerusalem?
Oh, if you like, yes, okay. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, yeah. There are some exercise for the students.
But Isaiah's packed with doubles, they're just not people's names.
Oh, okay. No, I'm thinking of people's names. it adds to the impact of it. And then you get this, in verse 12, this wonderful statement. Notice again it says, your son, your only son. That's going to happen three times, by the way, that phrase, your son, your only son. It's there again in verse 16. So it's sort of key point within the whole narrative. Three times God says, your son, your only son. So you're saying something now?
Yeah, Paul, sorry. The computer just froze for a second. What was the significance of the double calling out?
Well, I'm just saying that it happens only occasionally, and it seems to happen at significant moments.
Oh, okay.
And it's just like, it's an emphasis, really, but it's a call to attention, but also what I'm getting at is that if you were trying to put this in the mouth of God to say it, he might say the name twice, but slightly differently. Mm. The first one might be sort of Abraham, and then a softer Abraham. So he's called his attention, and now he's speaking softly or something. But
is it different to when Jesus says truly, truly? Then
no, not really.
No, not really. No. Okay.
Or he might have done it the opposite way, Paul. He might have been shouting at Abraham. Hoi, Abraham, can I hear?
Yeah. Second one might be louder. Yes. Again, interesting decisions you have to make when you're trying to do this sort of thing. Anyway, said it happens three times, and then you want to build the story to the next level, where, as you pointed out earlier, here perhaps comes the real character of the story, the ram caught by its horns, and so on, and relating to Jesus, and then the story ends with more times when God is spoken to from heaven a second time, and God says, I swear by myself, because you've done this and so on, I will bless you. And off you go. The story winds down to an interesting conclusion, having reached the heights of drama, probably on more than one occasion, probably it peaked two or three times in all that. Anyway, that's just to take you through, in some ways, a process of getting more out of the scripture by stopping, thinking, imagining, even trying to put it into films or some kind of story.
Paul?
Yes?
By myself I have sworn. A note that I've handwritten next to that saying, something important is being said or about to be done. It must be one of these phrases that isn't used very much where God says, by myself I have sworn.
Yes. Thank you, yeah. I can't get the number right. It was Derek Prince that said, always look out for when God swears by himself. The number was 20-odd or something. But it's obviously at a key moment, and usually it's to do with God's promises towards Israel. And in this case, it's towards Abraham, in readiness for Israel. When God swears by himself, there is no higher person or name or anything he can swear by. So at this point, he is absolutely laying his name, his reputation on the line. And I've always sort of put it like this, if you can bear with me saying it like this. If God decides to swear something by himself or by his name and then doesn't do it, he has to sort of step down as being God, because he's gone against who he is. It's almost like he's has to forfeit his claim to be God. In other words, he won't do it. But you're absolutely right. It's a very key and powerful expression that he's using there. I swear by myself. Now, I just wondered if you think any other passages that might work this way. I can think of one or two.
Paul?
Yes, hello?
So it's Monica.
Yeah.
I was just saying, out of that exercise just now, what I've altered in my mind is what Abraham looked like.
Yeah.
Because I've often thought, frail old man, but he's trekked nearly 3 days.
Yes.
They've taken the wood off the donkey. So all of that burnt, all that wood that's been chopped up, prepared.
Yes.
Two of them, him and Isaac, carrying it all.
Yeah.
Which we think is yonder far off, a long way to carry all that wood. And then it says he's laid Isaac on a 30-year-old man. He's laid him on the... And I'm thinking, this is a strong man.
Yes.
So actually, my casting of Abraham would be quite a strong old man.
Yeah, exactly. A good point. I hadn't think anyone has spotted that before. But yeah, that's definitely a good point. Yes, yes, you can't have him bent over or...
not frail.
He has to at least to... He has to be able to carry the same amount of wood for a while that Isaac did.
Paul, there tends to be a consensus that Isaac was about 30. Where does that come from?
Various other sources, Jewish sources, but also Josephus. But also, when you do work through the various passages around this one, before and afterwards, and although it's vague when it says some time later, if you work from a known point, like when Abraham was, when Isaac was born, or when Ishmael was born, when there's actual figures, and then when the next one, when Sarah is mentioned with a figure, and you take some time later being a few years and a few more years, that will give you an idea. I think the next thing we learn about...
May I say something?
Just let me finish this thought.
Oh, sorry.
The death of Sarah in chapter 23, she lives to be 127. Okay? So how old was she when Isaac was born?
90.
Yeah. That's where you get the upper limit of 37. But in fact, you've had another sometime later in verse 20. Okay? Yeah. So from that point of view, you go to 37 and come back a few years, maybe a few more years, and you can try and do something similar with whenever the earlier time limits are. But no one knows for sure, but certainly we know he's roughly in that range. Yes, hi, was it Pat?
Thank you.
Was it Pat?
No, it was Jenny. She wanted to mention something, but can I come back to you after Jenny?
Yes, okay. Sorry, Jenny next then.
I was going to say, it's so beautiful going through the story again, because there's so much parallels with the picture of Yeshua.
Yes.
In the Newer Testament, the fact that Isaac is unmarried, the fact that he's lifted up, it's the same verb in Hebrew as Yeshua going up, and also where we get the upper room from is the same verb. The fact that he was sacrificed in the Hebrew, it's called Makom, which is one of the names of God. The fact that he carried wood and was agony for him is the perfect picture of Yeshua carrying the cross.
Mm-hmm.
The word for wood is the same as tree, mm-hmm. which, of course, Abraham, when he cuts it, it's actually the word for splitting.
Right.
Which would also knife comes from the word eating, and Yeshua says, "Eat my body."
Okay.
The fact that when God swears by himself in the Hebrew, it's the word for seven. It's the same mm-hmm. word.
Yeah.
So God, when he, this is why we have a 7-day week, because it's God swearing his covenant over and over and over again. And so this would lead perfectly to the fact that Isaiah is probably the same age as Jesus was when Jesus was lifted up.
Yeah, Isaac, you mean, yeah.
Isaac.
You said Isaiah, but I think you mean Isaac still, don't you?
Yitzhak, yeah, Isaac will be the same age as Jesus was, because this is a picture of the Messiah. This is an account.
Exactly.
We probably don't have to, almost don't have to guess at his age, because it's going to be the same age as when Yeshua was lifted up.
Yes. Although,
and I love that the two facts that his father carried the wood, meaning God felt the pain of his son and the burden of his son being sacrificed, yes. and also the fact that the father laid his son, meaning the father lays Yeshua, his son. There's this complicit, united relationship between the two characters that's the perfect layover for. All being a pre-echo of Christ.
Yeah, that's good. Like, I mean, we can read so much back into it, which is fine. But of course, as a story in itself, it stands in terms of what it was saying at the time to the people there. I like the extra thing you brought in about when he was cutting the wood, You show him going to a tree, presumably, and cutting the bits off the tree.
It's a verb to split, and the word for wood is etz, which means tree.
Yes, so he went to a tree and split off branches and bits.
I think that's unlikely, because the green tree wouldn't burn. So,
what?
Green wood isn't ideal for burning, so probably he would have had trees that had been seasoned.
I forgot you're a wood expert, Nigel.
I was thinking...
But anyway, yeah, okay, yeah.
Can I
let's get Pat in now then, please, thanks. Pat?
It's just that you were asking about perhaps there was something else that somewhere else in the Bible that you could do the same sort of thing with.
Yeah.
I was thinking of John chapter 1, verse 1 to 14.
Oh, okay.
Ooh. Ambitious filmmaker.
Yeah, the very opening of John's Gospel. Actually, interesting enough, I was thinking the very end of John's Gospel.
Right.
John 21, I really love that. It's the breakfast on the shore, Jesus appearing to his disciples in Galilee, and when they're fishing, and Jesus cooking the breakfast, and then he has this conversation with Peter, and so on. I think that chapter would make a very good storyline to put forward. You could pick out David and Goliath, if you like, and other things like that. So, anyway, it's just a thought.
Can I make a comment about the difference between your approach, Paul, and Jenny's approach to this passage?
Yes, go on.
I think what you're trying to do is to say, let's strip off all the layers that have been laid on. And I think what Jenny is doing is saying, let's do what the Hebrew scriptures were originally intended to do, which is to foreshadow Yeshua.
Yes.
So I think you're both doing what God originally intended, but you're taking it back one stage further, and Jenny's taking it on one stage further, but they're both what God intended.
I'm just looking at the text that's there in Genesis and saying, how do we get into the story that's there? And then, yes, obviously as Christians, we've got so much extra that then we can go back and see happen. But the interesting thing is, unless you go back and read the story carefully as it is, you will even miss some of the extra things. It's easy to pick up, you know, Isaac, Jesus, the wood, the cross, and so on. But there's other things that we've picked up, perhaps by going into Genesis, that we hadn't even understood in terms of Jesus, because we didn't read the Genesis story quite as carefully. So you can go backwards and forwards once you know what you're doing. On that. So,
can I ask one other question then, just from reading the Genesis story? What's the significance of the... Abraham took in his hand the fire and the knife.
Okay. Do you mean why did he make the fire at that point and not when they got there? Or just you want to know how what the fire symbolizes in terms of what it's going to mean ultimately?
Yes, I mean, clearly he needed to bring fire with him, because to kindle fire... on a windy mountaintop would have been a fruitless exercise.
Okay, that's a good point.
Bring a torch of some sort. We don't know, really. I don't suppose you're a bushcraft expert and you know how fire was brought from one...
But my point... sorry, go on, finish first. But
from one Bedouin camp to another or whatever.
But my point is that I've probably read that several times without even knowing there was fire in his hand at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I've read it, I've come in the wood, then I remember the knife, and it's not easy to necessarily pick up everything on one reading, but by looking at it carefully, you would have to notice the fire and then ask the sort of questions that you're asking.
That's
part of the value of this.
To me, if I was filming this, I would have to spend a lot of time researching fire principles. Well,
all the different aspects of it, because once you're committed to doing this, you want to get it right. And there's a lot of detail in it. And it is amazing, people who are in the sort of visual arts and creative arts and that, in order to get it right and make a good thing of it, particularly when they're tackling something like the scriptures, there is a lot involved in doing that. But I say, my point isn't to turn you all into performance artists or directors of films, but to help you to think, if I can read the Bible with a bit more visual imagination, I might pick up things. And if they do have prophetic impact or resonance with things in the New Testament, then maybe I'll get even more out of that. And likewise, if I look at something that Jesus did in more sort of filmic detail, then it might help me to go back into the Old Testament as well. So we've nearly done, and I haven't got time to do this other thing in detail, but I'll mention it just in case you're going to you're going to F11. Some of you will be at F11, and on the first evening there's going to be not quite a film but a performance of Esther. Yes, people are still there. Yes, okay, good. I would have suggested, if you haven't already done so, has anyone recently read through the book of Esther in one go? Sat down and actually just read it all the way through?
I've read it about 5 times this week. I'm preaching on it.
Oh, okay. Again, I was going to suggest, can you find the storyline in terms of the ups and downs and the plot structure and so on? It has got this chiastic structure, this up and down, this ABA form, all the way through from beginning to end, with a central pivot at the literally at the halfway point where the king can't sleep. That's the moment when everything changes. That night the king could not sleep, and he gets out his history books, or recent history books, his diary if you like, and has a good old read to try and cure his insomnia, and the whole story pivots and changes around that point. And what was going to happen to one happens to the other, and vice versa. And the gallows that were built for one end up with someone else, and so on. So,
you have the reference to that verse.
Say again, sorry?
You have six. The reference.
It's the beginning of chapter six. It's chapter six, verse one. It is literally the halfway point, certainly in terms of the numbers, but anyway. That night, the king could not sleep.
Thank you.
If he had had a good night's sleep, the story would have ended badly. Certainly completely differently. This is the moment when everything changes. And he reads about what Mordecai had done in the past and the upward elevation of one person becomes his downfall, and vice versa, that's what I'm trying to say. Anyway, if you haven't been reading it 5 times this week, then give it a good old read. Try and do it all in one go. It's not too long. It's only about 20 minutes. Perhaps think how you might film that, though there's a lot in it, I must admit. And finally, from me...
Paul, can I make a comment on Esther? Because I've literally
been
a week. People state often that in Esther, God is not mentioned at all.
Yeah.
But we had a Hebrew scribe who was literally a proper Hebrew scribe, and I met him in Jerusalem in 2014, and he showed us how to write, he writes on scrolls, and how he counts all the squares and the empty spaces. And he basically said, if you read the book of Esther on a scroll, the top of every column, because you've got columns, obviously, in scrolls, and you know that Hebrew's left to right, but the top of every column, if you take the Hebrew letters down the way, it says the king, every single column.
It's what? Sorry, I missed part of it. It's what?
It says the king.
The king, okay.
If you take the Hebrew letters and go down the way, it's fascinating when you actually pulled it apart like that.
Okay. And did you know that actually the name of God does appear 5 times? In the Bible, in the book, even though it doesn't appear at all? Do you know what I mean by that?
No, you tell me.
Okay. In Esther chapter 1 and verse 20, and I can't really find it, but it'll come. Again, it's obviously in the Hebrew words.
Yeah.
in English, there's the bit. All the women will respect. Those four words in Hebrew, the initial letters spell out Yahweh. So what I'm trying to tell you is that five times there are four words where the initial letters spell out Yahweh.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
In some cases it's forwards, in some cases it's backwards. It's backwards when a Gentile is speaking. It's forwards when a Jew is speaking. It's backwards when God is overruling. It's forwards when God is ruling. And the fifth one is a bit different. So if you want the references, just because...
Yes, please.
So in 120, yep. You'll have to look this up in Hebrew to check it out. All the wives... Well, all the, what does it say in my... All the women will respect... that one is backwards.
Okay.
In 5:4, where it says something like, let the king and Haman come this day. I don't know what it is in different translations. Let the king together with Haman come today to a banquet. That is Yahweh forwards. In 5:13, where you've got the phrase "this avails me nothing," all this gives me no satisfaction in my version, but this avails me nothing, is also Yahweh backwards. And in 7:7, where's the phrase like "there was evil determined against him," or basically says here the king had already decided his fate, you've again got Yahweh forward. And in 7:5, just before then, who is he? Where is the man? It's not Yahweh as such. It's the same word, I am, that you find in Exodus 3:15. Now, you might say, just like I could have said to you about this guy in the scroll and so on, well, that's all very interesting. It sounds a bit like the Bible code and all the whatever. But we would spot this sort of thing if we suddenly were reading and we saw a sentence where the first five letters, the initials were J-E-S-U-S, particularly if the first word had a capital J because it's at the beginning, and we would suddenly think, oh, I can see the name of Jesus there because those five words begin with those letters, then we might think, oh, what's happening? So the question is, why is the name of God not mentioned at all, but why is it there hidden? And why is it behind the scenes? Well, some would say it's because God was at work behind the scenes in all this. He doesn't directly intervene, but you can tell his hand is involved in all this, if you like. He's seen at work in various places. Perhaps also the book was written at a dangerous time to mention the name of God, the Jewish God. And therefore it made it more acceptable to be read throughout the Persian Empire generally. So it made the story more appealing to those who didn't want to see God splashed all over it, if you like. Well, you can find other reasons if you like. People do tend to say, oh, why is God not in this book? Well, he is in the book, but you have to look for him, if you like.
Paul, can you just give us the last one again? I missed the last one.
Well, the last one being the fifth one is 7:5. And that is different because it isn't Yahweh. It's the Hebrew word for I am that you get in Exodus 3:15. So it's obviously like Yahweh.
Is it Anoki?
No, what I'm saying is in the others, you've got the YHVH. Four letters. In this one, you've got what have you got? You've got EHYH or something. So it's like Yahweh, but it isn't quite. I must admit, I don't quite know why someone's found that fifth one, but I would personally, I would have just stuck to the first four because it's a bit more obvious.
I've got down here, it was chapter 7 and verse 7, was evil determined against him?
Yes, that's the okay, the four that have got Yahweh in them are 120, 5:4, 5:13, and 7:7.
Yeah.
What your English translation is depends, obviously. I've just quoted what I've got here, but you'll have to find the equivalent of those words in the Hebrew.
Can I just ask, in 7:7, is it forwards or backwards?
Forwards, you said.
It is forwards, yes. Mm. It goes backwards, forwards, backwards, forwards. And apparently, I haven't checked this out recently, but it's backwards when a Gentile is speaking, but forwards when a Jew is speaking. No, anyway, I'll work that out. And in fact, the first one is about the queen by a Gentile. The second one is by the queen herself. The third one is about Haman. And the fourth one is by Haman. So there's probably lots of interesting little patterns about that. But to be honest, that's not the main point of the story, as I'm sure you know. But if you want to read it in one go, look for the structure where it is this chiastic, reflective thing through the whole book. You could say the first part is about the plot being formed. The second half is the plot being foiled, pivoting around this point where the king has a bad night. Look at the relative fate and fortune of the various people, see how it reverses, and so on. And it's all part of making the story memorable, and so on. But I'm sure it'd be even more memorable when we've seen it in action at F11. However, Steve managed to produce it, whoever's involved in it. Okay, I was going to finish with Jeremiah 6:16. Look it up if you want to. Just, I want to finish with saying this. Jeremiah 6:16, finish the whole thing off. This is what the Lord says. Jeremiah 6:16. This is what the Lord says. Stand at the crossroads and look, and ask for the ancient paths. Ask where the good way is and walk in it, and you will find rest for your souls. So two final points there. If ever you're standing at the crossroads, points of decision or indecision, practical or involving truth, I think God is saying, ask for the ancient path, which is like saying, open the ancient wells. Be guided by what was there in the past, the ancient path. Walk in this, and you will find rest for your souls. Familiar? You will find rest for your souls? Who said that?
Jesus
did. Yeah, no, well, yes, actually, it is in Psalm 23 as well. But when Jesus said, take my yoke upon you and learn of me, and you will find rest for your souls, he was hinting back at Jeremiah 6. Why? Because this is what the Lord says. Okay, if you walk in my path, you will find rest for your souls. And Jesus was saying, I am God. And if you take my yoke on you. And the yoke again is about teaching, it's about being a disciple. Obviously not about farming, doesn't want you to go and be a farmer, but to take someone's yoke is to yoke yourself to someone as a disciple to a teacher. And if we yoke ourselves to Jesus, we find rest for our soul, we find shalom deep within, because our minds have stopped fluttering around, we stop questioning and wondering, we stop trying to sort things out for ourselves. Once we've learned to listen to God and find the ancient paths, then something settles deep within us and we find rest for our souls. So that's my prayer for you still, that you will indeed, anytime you're at a point of indecision, find the ancient path, open the ancient well, and find rest for your souls. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you.
Can we finish the recording? I hope we got enough of interest in the recording to make it worthwhile.
Thanks, Sarah.